Jesus tells us to take up our cross and follow him. You're listening to Crosswalk with Pastor Steve Winery. Crosswalk is the radio ministry of Calvary Chapel Tri-Cities, and it is our aim to lead you to the cross through the teaching of God's Word.
Come break our culture, tear down our pride. Lord, take your church and purify. Oh, we are ready to stand in your love. Come, King Jesus, deliver us. Oh, my King is coming. Restless hearts, be still.
Today's Crosswalk is pre-recorded from Truth Set Free.
So John's question is about apparent age, and we were just talking about the miracle that Jesus did in multiplying the loaves and the fish. So a loaf of bread looks like it's come from grain. The grain has to grow, etc. Then it has to be harvested, and then it has to be turned into flour, and then there's a baking time, and so on. And so it's got an apparent age to somebody who comes on it after Jesus has performed the miracle, but in reality, the age is instantaneous because Jesus did a miracle. You know, the same thing with the fish. The fish have to be larvae and then grow up into fish and be caught and the whole thing cooked and et cetera. And so there's an apparent age there. With Adam on the day that he was created would be one day old. But he wasn't created as a one-day-old infant, for example. He was created as a fully functional man. So the guy's got an apparent age of at least 18, 20, you know, whatever age God gave to him. But in reality, he's only one day old. And so there's an apparent age, but there's an actual age in creation. And so when you're talking about what God did specifically with the earth, one of the things you have to deal with, and this is something that I dealt with when I first became a Christian, is the whole issue of why people think that the earth is old. And so what they're using, what they have to use, is radiometric dating. And that's where you take isotopes of certain elements, actually radioactive elements, and you measure their decay rate. And you get what's called a half-life. And so the half-life of uranium-238 is 4.5 billion years. So you find a rock with that's half uranium, half lead, because that's what it ends up decaying into at its stable end, daughter element. You find a rock that's half lead and half uranium. If your assumptions are correct, then that rock is 4.5 billion years. But you don't know that because your assumptions may not be correct. So the assumption is that you started out with something that was pure uranium. You don't know that. It could have been one quarter uranium, three quarters lead, and now that looks older than it actually is. Or you could go the other direction. And you're assuming that the process rate is continuous, and you don't know that. And we know that those process rates can be changed by chemicals, even. And the third thing that you're assuming is that it's in a closed environment, a closed system, and that's not true at all. And so nothing's touched that rock for 4.5 billion years. And the other thing that you've got with that, that's where they get the date for the age of the Earth. That is not an Earth rock. They dated a meteor. And so there's a bunch of assumptions that go along with that. And so just the assumptions are problematic. So you don't know that, you know. And just to give you an example, you walk into a room and there's a candle that's burning, and right next to it is another candle that hasn't been burned. How long has that candle been burning? And again, you have to make assumptions. You have to make the assumption that the candle was whole when it was lit. You have to make the assumption that nothing has increased the burn rate. Nobody's been blowing a fan at it to oxygenate it and that kind of stuff. And nobody's come along and cut off the bottom portion of the candle, for example. You're making those assumptions when you do that. And those assumptions aren't necessarily correct because you were not there when the whole process started. Only one that was there when the whole process started is God himself. So there would be an apparent age. When you're talking about trees, you'd have exactly the same thing. You have to have trees that function. God made the trees, and they bore fruit. And so there's a process rate with all of that stuff. And if it's an instantaneous creation, coming on it after the fact, you're going to assume that the tree is however old it would be. So for example, I've got a nectarine tree that I planted probably 6 years ago, and it's finally bearing nectarines. And so 6 years old, at that point. And so on, and you've got that kind of stuff. Back to the radiometric dating. They use this to try to get billions of years. Whenever radiometric dating is used on a rock of known age, and these rocks are always lava rocks, because that's where the radioactive elements are. They're in the lava rocks. So, for example, Mount St. Helens was dated anywhere from about 250,000 years. The lava dome that was built up in 1984 on Mount St. Helens was dated at anywhere from about 280,000 years to 2.8 million years, 6 years after it was formed. There's something wrong with the radiometric dating. It was only 6 years old. And so this is the argument that you have to look at. And one of the things that you're going to run into is, if you run into anybody that was like me before I became a Christian, I would just say your God is lying, basically, especially when you're talking about process rates for radiometric dating. And again, you can have things that look old in the sense of apparent age, but you're not going to have a situation where science itself is going to point to the fact that thing is that old without assumptions. There has to be assumptions. If your assumptions are correct, it's old. If your assumptions are incorrect, then it is not old. And what I'm telling you is the assumptions with radiometric dating are demonstrably wrong. Scientifically, they're demonstrably wrong. And so you can't get millions of years out of radiometric dating without being wrong on every historical date of a rock. You have other dating methods that can be used. So the amount of salt in the ocean, for example, will only allow you on the outside millions of years. They don't use that because it doesn't give you enough time for evolution and so on. There are a number of dating methods that you could use. You could use the decay rate of the magnetic field on the Earth. That only gives you an outside limit of thousands of years if you use the same assumptions that scientists use for radiometric dating. And there's a problem with that. They don't do that because it doesn't fit their paradigm. It doesn't fit their philosophy. And so there are plenty of dating methods that are scientific, using exactly the same assumptions, that give you thousands of years and much less than billions of years. Actually, all of them give much less than billions of years. And so radiometric dating is the only one that actually allows for that, and it is demonstrably flawed. So that's my take on that.
So if you're going to simplify your answer, just for a clear definition, you wouldn't say that it's both old and new. You would say that it's new, but depending on how you're measuring it, it can look old because your premises are wrong.
Right, exactly. That's it. So for example, when you're looking at mankind and how long mankind has been around on the planet, we have two things that they're looking at, and they use radiometric dating for this also. They date lava rocks in the vicinity of a fossil, or ash in the vicinity of a fossil, to try to get a date, and they get millions of years for the supposed ancestors of mankind, right? When they're talking about actual Homo sapiens, the outside limit for the dating of basically what we would look at as a person, as a human being, the outside limit is 200,000 years. And that number is coming down as time goes on. When you look at history, you only get about 5,000 years. And when I'm talking about history, I'm not talking about anything that has to do with C14 dating, that kind of stuff. I'm talking about documents, literally historical documents, and things that we can date reliably. You can only get, humanity only goes back about 5,000 years at the max, 5,000 years. And so to go along with the evolutionary paradigm, you have to believe that people who were as smart as us, some of them had larger brains than we do, were for the last 195,000 years collectively picking their noses and hanging out in caves. And all of a sudden, 5,000 years ago, everybody decided to build a city, plant a farm, and write a book. Everybody. And it's just ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And so we don't have anything reliable that dates humankind as being that old. Nothing reliable that dates the earth as being that old. So,
okay, I'm going to paraphrase this next question as well. Again, okay. I sent this to Steve. He read the whole thing. Basically, it goes like this. God's outside of time, therefore he knows the end from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Inside his creation, we still have a free will choice. Even though he knows what we're going to choose, or the fact that he knows the end from the beginning, it doesn't dictate our choice. We still have the ability to choose, even though God knows what's going to happen.
Right.
And so how do you articulate it? This shows up in different theological points, whether you're talking about Arminianism, Calvinism, free will. Does God make you do it? Are you actually doing it? Is God still sovereign when you have that choice? So in a nutshell, unpack that for us.
Okay. One of the things that he talks about in the question that you sent me is this. So from our point of view, the Lord steps in and can change our direction, but wasn't that a part of the script? And then he says, I would not say that God predetermined our end. I would just think that he knows the choices we will make before we make them. And in that sense, we've predetermined our own destiny. And that's problematic in the situation, because what the Bible clearly states is, just like you said, that God knows the end from the beginning. He knows exactly what our choices are going to be. He cannot learn. And so God has foreknowledge. Foreknowledge is not the same as sovereignty. Sovereignty is something that's completely different. Foreknowledge is not the same as predeterminism. Predetermining something is totally different than foreknowledge. And one of the things that you have to wrap your head around is the fact that God can have foreknowledge of everything that I'm going to do without him ever doing anything. And he can leave me alone, and everything that I do is according to my own will and not his. This can happen when you're talking about foreknowledge. And so mixed in with that is going to be God's sovereignty. And God's sovereignty has to do with the choices that God's going to make. And so if my free will is causing me to do something that is going against his sovereign will, He can enter in, and he does. We have examples of this in the Bible. He can enter in and change circumstances such that I don't get to do what I want to do. And at that point, what God is doing is exercising his sovereignty. Here's another thing about this. Allowing me a free will is also an act of God's sovereignty. God can sovereignly leave me alone and still be sovereign. And so, again, when you're looking at these issues, you need to define terms, and you need to keep the terms in their lane, basically.
So that last one was important for me, because people will use that and go, oh, well, you have all power, which means you can thwart God's sovereignty, which makes him powerless. Well, not if God's sovereignty allowed me to make a choice and he just leaves it at that.
Right.
What they've done is they've redefined sovereignty to their logic, right. And therefore, if I have a free will, then I'm more powerful for God. Well, that's not the definition the Bible gives to
right.
sovereignty.
Yeah, and it's that's not the definition of sovereignty at all.
Yeah. When you first hear that, it can be off-putting if you don't understand these definitions.
Right. And so people need to understand between foreknowledge and the predetermination of God. So I always like to use the example of DVRing a football game. So I do church on Sundays. If there's a football game that I want to watch, I'm going to miss it. So I DVR the thing, and say I'm on the way home and I have the radio on and I'm listening to a sports station, and they tell me what the plays are going to be that cause the winning team to score, right? And so I can go home, turn my TV on, turn on the game, sit there with my wife, and I can predict what the running backs are going to do. I can predict what the quarterback is going to do. I can predict what the play is going to be. I can predict what the defense is going to do in response, and I can predict the score. But I haven't done anything. I just have foreknowledge from my point of view. I haven't seen the game yet. I have foreknowledge of the outcome of the game, and that's all that's happened. I haven't done anything with the running backs. I haven't influenced them on any kind of level. None of that has taken place, and that's what foreknowledge is. That's a great picture of what foreknowledge is.
Yeah.
And now if I'm God, and I'm watching a football game, and I don't like the way the score comes out, or whatever, or I want to influence the game on some level, then I can step in,
right,
and I can influence the players, and I can influence the circumstances, and all that kind of stuff, and that's my sovereignty at that point. And so, you know, that's when we look at it, as far as God's concerned, He knows the end from the beginning, and so the Bible talks about my life is like a story that's been told. Psalm 139 talks about the fact that God knows my end before it ever takes place. And so story that's been told, a book that's been written, and have real choices. And again, as you said, God knows what those choices are going to be. And so He's not surprised by them. Some of those choices, just in my own life, as I've gone through my life, God has overruled my choices. And so in practical ways, God has stepped in and caused me to make a different decision in a situation, or He didn't allow my decision to go through because He stepped in. But He's not doing that in everything that's going on in my life in that sense. He allows me choice, and so I get to respond to what the Bible says in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, for example, when it tells me what love is and how I'm supposed to apply love. He allows me to make a choice there. Again, knowing what my choice is going to be.
Yeah.
So from my point of view, it's not a script. From God's point of view, it's a story that's already done. And yes, God does know my end. But again, that doesn't mean that He's written a script in Himself in that sense. So,
okay.
There you go.
Yeah.
One of the questions of the ages, and I just defined it in just a couple of minutes. There you go. And again, you know, people have been arguing about this for hundreds of years.
For sure.
Yeah.
All right. This next question was actually from last week. We just didn't have time to get to it. And the reason I point that out is because of what just happened this last Saturday in our country. This was actually before that. And so the question is, when is the appropriate time to rebel? Now, you got kind of rowdy on Sunday. Not rowdy for me, but just in general of what I think the atypical American church sermon is, not to try to put you in the box of Christendom or whatever, but we're in a place that it's getting increasingly more radical, especially for believers, times that I've never seen in my lifetime of stuff. And this question comes up. It came up during COVID. It's still there. But as a believer, when you're approaching this, and it's from the faith-based, biblical, what does God want you to do point of view, when is it appropriate to rebel?
COVID.
For sure.
You know, it's like, that was appropriate.
Not to cut you off, but yeah. I still remember, like, maybe I got issues or something I need to forgive or whatever, but it's amazing to me how quickly everyone just goes back to business as usual. But I still remember, like, when I walk into Costco, you know what I think of? Mm-hmm. Them chasing my wife down the aisle because she's not wearing her mask.
Yeah.
Because I'm the one dude in there that's like, freedom! Because I'm rebelling. It's like,
yeah.
But anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
So COVID for sure.
There's places I don't want to go because of the way that people got treated during COVID. So they lost my business, basically. So you rebel when the world is telling you to do something that God tells you to do exactly the opposite on. That's when you rebel, and it needs to be every time. And so I know that you're probably talking about rebelling against the government and taking the government down and that kind of thing. That needs to be, you know, when you are looking at the American Revolution, there were years and years of American patriots going over to England and talking to the authorities over there. There was a lot of prayer that was involved in that. before they were finally driven to the point where it's like, this was ridiculous. And it was after King George came in with his troops, sent the troops over, and they started having, you know, violent interactions with the colonists. And that's when the American Revolution started, if you know your history. And so I think that when we're looking at rebellion against this world, I think that most of this stuff does not need to be taken care of with a gun or with violence. One of the things that I've noticed about the people who are trying to, the anarchists and the people in political situations that are trying to take away your freedom, is that they're bullies. They are, you have what's called the tyranny of the weak, in the sense that they've tried to use a system against people to shut them down and shut them up. And there is a lot to be said for just standing up and telling people no. You just tell them no. You don't have to be mean about it. You don't have to get in their face about it. You don't have to threaten. You don't have to do anything like that. You just go no, and what are you going to do about it? And what people who are like that will do, what they'll do is they'll back down. And so COVID, one of the things that happened was Governor Inslee had a four-phase deal for coming out of COVID. And the last phase, the fourth one, including allowing churches to open with 50 people. Well, my church has thousands of people. And so that's not tenable. And at the same time, he was going to allow movie theaters to open, which have exactly the same type of venue as a church, with 450 people. And so when that came out, I just went, okay, all done, you know, and now we're going to open up church and, you know, come and put me in jail if you want to. You know, and I happen to live in an area that's pretty conservative, and we don't have police officers who would have done that. But it wouldn't have mattered to me if I lived in Seattle. I would have done exactly the same thing and then said, come and put me in jail if you want to. And but this is what I'm going to do. And, you know, we opened up because of that. And what ended up happening was there was a suit that was brought against Inslee and the state of Washington. And I was asked to join the suit, and I said, yes, absolutely, I will join the suit. And what happened was Inslee backed down. And so it could be taken care of like that. It's like, well, you know, what's he going to do? Come in and put a pastor in jail? And all you have to do is stand up against people like this. And I think that the standing up needs to be practical and pretty straightforward. You know, we've got situations in public schools where kids are being basically groomed by teachers and by counselors. And my kids are grown now.
If
my kid was in a public school, in any school, and I found out that there was an adult that was teaching them things about sex that are anti-biblical, against what my family believes, that kind of thing, I would have been down at that place and they would have stopped, or I would have gone to jail. I'm a Christian. I love Jesus, and I don't want to do things to people, but punching a guy in the nose who is talking to my seven-year-old about sex is completely appropriate, and I wouldn't have a problem doing it.
That's all the time we have for today. If you have questions for Pastor Steve, please email me at crosswalkradio@gmail.com, or you can leave a voicemail or text message to 707-872-7677. Crosswalk is the radio ministry of Calvary Chapel Tri-Cities in Kennewick, Washington. If you're wanting to know more about what it means to follow Christ, then please contact our church office by phone at 509-736-2086. You can also look us up online at calvary-tricities.org. There you will find a wide variety of Steve's teachings to listen to or to download for free. If you want to join us for church sometime, we're located at 10611 West Clearwater Avenue in Kennewick, Washington. Our Sunday service times are 8:30 and 10:30 a.m. We also meet at 6 p.m. Sundays and 6:30 p.m. Wednesdays in our sanctuary. We hope you've been blessed today and will join us again next time on Crosswalk.
My King is come.